I shook my head.
For a miracle.
I wish it was so, I said, taking her hand in mine. I wish it was so.
For you, she said.
For me.
The miracle of Lourdes is acceptance, Sam. I ask God to help you to understand and to accept yourself.
And I thought again of that moment at the baths when I had forgiven so many who had bullied me, and in so doing, I had forgiven myself. Could it have been my mother's prayer? Could it have been her final act as my mother to once again take care of me?
Come close, she said. I want to see the eyes that looked up at me the moment you were born.
She touched my cheek.
My baby,
she whispered.
When you were born, I thanked the Blessed Mother for making you extraordinary.
You were always there to take care of me, I said.
Everything happens for a reason, Samuel. Never forget that. Have faith in God's will.
Then she closed her eyes. They would be the last words she ever spoke to me. 12. My mother did not regain consciousness, but she also did not die on the plane or during the transport back to her house. She was too stubborn. She once told me she wanted to die in her own bed with the man she loved beside her. She got her wish. Her wake and funeral were held at Our Lady of Mercy. The pews were filled with so many people from our past that the pastor had to open the choir loft, something usually only done during the holidays for the attendees my father had called Christmas Catholics. I buried her at the Catholic cemetery. 6 weeks later, I buried my father beside her. He simply could not live without her. 13. Several months after my parents' deaths, at the end of January, I walked in the door with 2 six-packs of Corona and margarita mix. Sunday nights, Mickey and I either cooked or went out for Mexican food. Tonight, Ernie and Michelle were joining us. They had taken their youngest son off to college the prior weekend after a few semesters at the local community college, and we were celebrating their freedom as empty nesters. I recalled Dr. Fukumara's statement to me during my vasectomy consult that he and his wife were empty nesters and could have sex in any room in the house. When I said the same thing to Ernie on the phone, he'd responded, "Yeah, but do you?" Mickey stood at the kitchen counter, sprinkling cheese over the top of a neatly arranged tray of tacos. Douglas and Blue, the 2 pit bull puppies Mickey had rescued from the Burlingame pound, sat at her feet, hoping for spillage. Mickey and I settled into a regular routine. We traded off cooking dinner and doing the chores around the house. To keep busy after my parents' deaths, I spent my free time working on bringing Fernando to live with us. Mickey loved to garden, something she got from those afternoons she'd spent with my mother. In no time, she had transformed my bleak and neglected front yard into something worthy of a picture in a magazine. A part of me, the insecure part, still had moments of anxiety. Moments when I would drive down the block, certain Mickey's blue Honda with the white racing stripe would be gone. But the car was always there, and so was she. I should have been happy with the situation. I should have accepted this was all Mickey had ever been capable of giving. Marriage was just not something she wanted to consider. When I brought it up, she had brushed it aside, asked why we needed a piece of paper to tell us what we already knew, that we loved each other and would never leave the other. But that was not my nature. I was my mother's son, and it was our way to rock the boat. "Do you want to marry me?" I asked, putting the Corona on the counter. The cheese stopped falling. When Mickey did not answer, did not look at me, I made a joke, which was also my nature. "This would make it official," I said. "Then we wouldn't have to worry what name Douglas and Blue should use at school, or if they should hyphenate it. And there's Fernando," I said. I'm still optimistic, despite the red tape. I'm optimistic we can have what my parents had. A family. Mickey finally looked up at me. I love you, Sam. I love you too. But you know how I feel about marriage. I tried to smile. Is it against your religion or something? Because I'm willing to convert. Don't joke. Help me to understand. I want to have what my parents had. I thought we both wanted that. We can't, Sam. I think we can. No. Why not? She picked up the tray of tacos as if to move past me. You deserve someone better. I don't want someone better. I want you. Thanks a lot. We laughed. I took the tray and placed it on the counter and put my hands around her waist. So, is that a yes? She put her arms around my neck. You're sweet, Sam. I regret a lot of things I did in my life. I can't take them back. Is that what this is about? I don't care about your past or who you've been with or what you've done. Do you love me? I've always loved you, Sam, even when you didn't know it. Then why isn't that enough? I gave away a part of me in my youth, Sam. I don't expect you to understand, but it's a part I can't get back. It's a part that you deserve. What? I was dumbfounded, but then again, maybe I wasn't. Maybe this was one of those things that Mickey had spent so much time talking about and crying about with my mother for all those years. At that moment, I felt fear, certain Mickey would tell me that I was going to lose her, too. But before Mickey could answer, I heard Ernie's BMW in the driveway. For such a great athlete, his timing has always sucked, I said. Can we table this for the night? Maybe talk about it when I get back from my conference? In the morning, Mickey was to leave for a College of Optometry conference in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, on advances in the treatment of keratoconus, a degenerative disorder of the eye. I had intended on going with her, but we had turned our practice into a free eye clinic for the disadvantaged, and I needed to be there. Okay, I said, knowing it best not to push her. We'll just enjoy Mexican night. Gracias, señor. De nada, señorita. We ate our tacos and drank margaritas while listening to the guitar riffs of Carlos Santana. A toast, Ernie said, to good friends. We raised our glasses. Is that the best you can do? I asked. Thank God you didn't give the valedictorian speech. Don't start with me, you red-eyed son of the devil. Here's to life, I said, and the three people in mine who've helped to make it extraordinary. I love you all. You're not gonna kiss me, are you? Ernie asked. Michelle hit him with a piece of tomato. At just after 10, Michelle nodded to Ernie, who was falling asleep on my couch. Well, I better get Romeo here home before he passes out on me. Our first weekend without kids, and he'll be snoring before his head hits the pillow. Ernie perked up suddenly. Did someone mention sex? Michelle looked at Mickey. Ah, the romance, she said. After Ernie and Michelle left, Mickey and I snuggled on the couch under a blanket to watch Tom Hanks in The Green Mile. Douglas and Blue curled up beside us. I didn't regret asking Mickey to marry me, but it troubled me when she put herself down and discounted who she was as a person. I knew it had to be an old and deep scar, one I was sure was inflicted in childhood, too deep, perhaps, for me to reach. I resigned myself to our arrangement and promised I would not ask the question again. That night we made love with a passion ferocious even for Mickey, and afterward, she clung to me as never before, as if she might lose me if she let go. 14. Wednesday afternoon, I took Blue and Douglas for an afternoon walk, and I realized that I had not heard from Mickey in nearly 24 hours, though I was uncertain of the time change, if any, in Puerto Vallarta. I was consciously trying to give her some space, mindful of my mistake of asking her to marry me, but I couldn't get out of my mind the way Mickey had clung to me that night, or the memories of the other times in my life when Mickey had spooked and left. When I returned home, I got the dog's water. Then I called her. The call went straight to voicemail. I took to the task of making dinner, listening to jazz with the doors open, enjoying a gentle, cool cross breeze, and waiting anxiously for my phone to buzz or ring. 3 hours later, there had been no call from Mickey. I tried calling her again, but got no answer. I started to worry that something could be wrong and went to the fridge and retrieved the piece of paper detailing the conference and the hotel. I dialed the number. "Mickey Kennedy's room, please." I heard the desk clerk's fingers striking keys. "I'm sorry, sir. We do not have a registration for anyone under that name." My heart started to sink. "Could you check Michaela Kennedy?" After another beat, this one shorter, the clerk said, "I'm sorry, sir. There is no Kennedy registered." "Could she have checked out early? I can't give that information, sir." "Please, this is her husband. I'm worried about her. She was to check in Monday night, and I haven't heard from her, which is unlike her. I haven't been able to contact her on her cell phone." I heard a pause, the desk clerk debating with himself. "Hold on," he said. My mind was racing, and I could not still my thoughts. Then the clerk came back and said, "We had a guest here by that name, sir, but she canceled her reservation after one night. She checked out Tuesday morning." I closed my eyes, a stabbing pain in my chest. "Is there anything else I can help you with, sir?" "No," I said, disconnecting, my heart continuing to sink. In my mind, I replayed our conversation when I'd asked Mickey to marry me. She'd said she couldn't, that she had given away a part of her she couldn't get back, that I deserved someone better. And then she had clung to me as if she would never see me again. I wondered if Mickey had already made plans to leave but couldn't bring herself to tell me. If that had been the reason she'd clung to me. She stayed to help me get through the heartache and pain of my mother's and father's deaths. But Mickey was still Mickey, at times rash and unpredictable. Marriage frightened her, which meant I had frightened her. And Mickey no doubt rationalized that she could never make me completely happy. And therefore, she was doing us both a favor by leaving. I shut the doors and turned off the lights. I contemplated calling Ernie, but he and his family were in Europe to celebrate Mr. Cantwell's 70th birthday. My mother and father were dead. There was no one. I was alone. I slumped on the couch, grief-stricken and anxious. Douglas in blue, sensing my anguish, curled up beside me. And then I heard her, my mother. "Have faith, Samuel." I raised my head, almost expecting to see her standing in my living room. "Have faith in what?" I asked. "Have faith in what, Mom?" But the voice in my head would not be silenced. "Have faith, Samuel. We don't always know God's will." "Is his will to make me miserable?" I asked, but this time there was no answer. I went upstairs and sat on the bed, uncertain what to do, feeling my anxiety starting to spread. My eyes were drawn to the top drawer of my dresser, but I fought the urge to open it. I had contemplated putting my mother's rosary in her casket, but at the last moment I held on to it, remembering how she had walked across the courtyard at the Baths in Lourdes to hand it to me. Her dying act. I lay my head back against the pillows. Blue and Douglas entered and immediately jumped onto the bed, tails wagging. My eyes were again drawn to that top drawer. This time I stood and crossed the room. On the dresser was the Bible Sister Beatrice had given me as an 8th grade graduation present, and wedged in the mirror was the card of St. Christopher and the Irish blessing that our pastor, Father Brogan, gave me the night he expelled David Bateman. I opened the top drawer. The beads were well worn and misshapen. The gold crucifix and the links between the beads had lost their luster. I held my mother's rosary in the palm of my hand, staring at it, debating with myself, realizing I'd never won a debate with my mother in my entire life, and I knew I wouldn't now either. I pinched the cross between my thumb and index finger and began as she had taught me when I had been just a little boy. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. In between each prayer, I ask God not to take Mickey from me. I ask my mother to intercede, to ask the Blessed Mother to bring Mickey home to me. Have faith, Samuel. I started the second decade, then the third. I was having trouble breathing, getting the words out, but I would not give in. I plunged from one bead to the next, thinking again of my mother and begging her to intercede, bargaining with her. I won't question God's will, I said. Mickey is all I'll ever want or need. I'll take up your mantle, your devotion. I'll offer my pain up for some poor soul in purgatory. I'll return to church. Just please, Mom, please don't let him take Mickey from me. Whatever second thought she might be having, whatever it is she thinks makes her not good enough, please let her see how much I love her. I don't know how many stanzas I completed before fatigue became so great I could not keep my eyes open. I awoke fully dressed to the bells in the tower of Our Lady of Mercy ringing out and sun streaming through my bedroom window. Blue and Douglas, curled on the bed, sat up. I could not immediately recall the last time I'd heard the bells, and then that moment came to me. I had been in Dr. Fukumara's office, about to have a vasectomy. But I had imagined those bells, hadn't I? I wondered if I could be imagining them again and quickly went downstairs, pulled open the front door, and stepped out onto the porch. Blue and Douglas remained at my feet. It was not my imagination. The bells rang as loud and true as Ernie had rung those bells in the sixth grade at the all-school mass. Standing on the porch, I realized something else. I no longer felt anxious about Mickey. I felt the same comforting warmth and peace come over me as I had felt in Lourdes when it seemed to be radiating from my chest. I had been unable to define the feeling until that moment, and then it became very clear to me. It felt like my mother's loving embrace. It felt like it felt when she wrapped her arms around me when I was a boy in need of comfort. Spiritu Santo, the Italian man had knowingly whispered. Spiritu Santo. Douglas and Blue began to bark. Mickey had trained them not to leave the porch, so they remained on the top step, barking, tails whipping the air, collars rattling. I looked down the street but did not see anyone out walking their dog or an approaching car. What is it? I said. Blue looked up at me, but Douglas's gaze remained on the street. When I looked again, the taxi appeared over the slight rise in the road, slowing as it neared, and then turning into the driveway. Blue and Douglas were ecstatic, whimpering and whining, tails whipping at high speed. The back door of the cab opened, and Mickey Kennedy stepped out. 15. Mickey looked up at me and smiled, but it had a sad, "I'm sorry," look to it. The dogs leaped and jumped all around me, but did not leave the porch until I stepped down. They bolted to her. She started to cry, apologizing even before I reached her. "I got your messages. I'm sorry, Sam. I know I worried you." "Why didn't you call?" "I didn't have any service." "I spoke to you Tuesday. I left." "Where? Where did you go?" "I wanted it to be a surprise, the best surprise. I'm sorry, Sam. I didn't see all your calls until we landed. I know what you were thinking, Sam. I know you thought I'd left." I didn't care. I didn't care about anything except that Mickey was there in my arms. I kissed her and hugged her tight. After a while, she said, "Let's go inside." I paid the cab driver and carried Mickey's bag inside, dropping it in the entry at the foot of the stairs. Mickey sat at the kitchen table. After we caught our breath, she said, "We never did finish the conversation the night before I left." "It's okay," I said. "No, it's not. Not if we're going to marry." I stared at her, dumbfounded. "I can't have children, Sam. It happened when I was younger. I had to have a hysterectomy. I didn't want to marry you and not be able to give you children. You deserve children. You're a good man and will make a wonderful father.
I don't care about that, I said. Why didn't you ever tell me?
I told your mother. I should have told you. But you know how hard it can be when years go by and you don't say anything. For so many years, when you were away, I rationalized that we would never be together, and so it didn't matter. But now, I should have, Sam. I should have told you.
I felt a sense of relief that it was not something else, that it wasn't some fatal disease. You're all I've ever wanted.
But you do want children. I know you do, because you didn't go through with the vasectomy. You want to be a father, Sam. I've known since that day that you wanted to be a father. I just didn't have an answer.
Not until you came back and spoke of Fernando. I wanted to wait to give you an answer until we knew for certain.
Fernando? I knew that he was meant for you, for both of us.
I'm still hopeful. Mickey raised a hand. I've been working on accelerating the process ever since you told me. Your mother helped.
My mother?
Mickey nodded. I was hoping she'd live long enough to see her grandson. She was so happy for you, Sam. Happy for us.
I don't understand.
You said you wanted to adopt him, but that it would help if we were married. Your mother and I filled out additional paperwork.
You and I are married, Sam. It's the only fib I ever heard your mother tell in her entire life.
My mother lied? I said.
White lie, Mickey said. Anyway, I got the call from the orphanage as soon as I landed in Mexico. I checked out and flew to Costa Rica. All our paperwork is being processed, Sam. All they need is to personally interview you. But it's a formality. A woman at the orphanage said she already knew you, that she'd been in the room when you met Fernando.
I remember her.
She vouched for you, Sam.
Mickey stood and took my hand.
She wrote a beautiful letter of reference for you. So did your colleagues at Orbis. Fernando will be our son, Sam.
Our son?
Mickey nodded and smiled. We'll be a family, Sam. If you'll still have me.
I was speechless. I felt numb, and for a moment I could not move. I thought of my mother.
Don't move, I said. Then I started up the stairs. Where are you going?
Not a step, not a single step, I said. I ran into the bedroom and opened the dresser, grabbing the black box beside my mother's rosary. I hurried back downstairs. Mickey was in the same spot. For once in her life, she'd stayed put. I dropped to a knee, my heart beating fast. I wanted to get the words out before she could say another thing. Mickey Kennedy, I said, will you marry me? I opened the black box and produced the diamond that had adorned my mother's wedding ring for more than 40 years. I'd had it reset and surrounded it with tiny red rubies.
Epilogue.
The first Sunday after we brought Fernando home, we took him to Our Lady of Mercy Church. We arrived early, and I instinctively turned to the pew that had become my mother and father's pew during their years of devotion. Mickey had not rekindled her faith, but she wanted one for Fernando. When he was older, he could choose for himself. As Mickey sat in the pew, I took Fernando by the hand and walked him to the alcove to the right of the altar, where we knelt before the Blessed Mother. Este es la Madre Bendita, I said. This is the Blessed Mother. Ask her to help you, and she will. Prayers are like coins you put into a piggy bank. You store them for when you need them most. Fernando looked at me and shook his head.
¿Qué es una alcancía?
He asked. What is a piggy bank? I tousled his hair and started to laugh. We intended to enroll Fernando at the local public school, which had an English as a second language program. But early that summer, I received a phone call from the principal at OLM asking to meet with Mickey and me. She also asked that we bring Fernando. Patricia Brannick sat in the same office in which my mother and I had first encountered Sister Beatrice, though the pictures on the wall were now of Pope John Paul II
and a priest I presumed to be OLM's pastor, but whom I had not yet met. The room was softer, a yellow color. Plants and vines grew in pots in the corners.
"I did not receive an enrollment application for Fernando," Mrs. Brannick said.
Mickey and I explained our decision to enroll Fernando at the public school. Patricia Brannick listened politely, then she said, "Don't be silly. You'll enroll him here, and we'll work through this together." I smiled.
"It's not just the language, Mrs. Brannick.
I'm concerned about a young boy with red eyes attending a Catholic school."
Her brow furrowed.
"Well, of course you are. That's why I've asked you here, to alleviate those concerns. I assure you, Fernando's presence will be a blessing," she said. "What better way to teach these children Christian ideals?"
Then she smiled. "You can argue with me all you want, Mr. Hill, but I will tell you now that no grandchild of Madeline Hill is going to attend a public school. She saw to that."
"I'm sorry?" I asked, confused, and glanced at Mickey, thinking perhaps this was another of her and my mother's plans. But Mickey shook her head and shrugged.
"Your mother came to visit me before she went into the hospital. She told me that you would be adopting a boy from South America with ocular albinism, and that you would be reluctant to send him to OLM because of your past experiences. I knew your mother from attending 6 o'clock Mass."
"And she told you she wanted me to enroll Fernando at OLM?"
"She did more than that, Mr. Hill. She paid Fernando's tuition, all 8 years at today's prices. Your mother was no dummy."
I laughed. Never one to sit quietly in the boat, my mother had spent her life taking care of me, and now she was taking care of her grandson.
"No, she certainly wasn't, Mrs. Brannick," I said. "My mother was extraordinary."
"Then it is settled." Mrs. Brannick pushed back her chair and offered her hand across the desk. "I will greet you atop the red-tiled steps off Cortez Avenue on the first day of school. Do you know the steps I'm talking about?"
"All too well," I said. "All too well."
The weekend before his first day of school, Mickey and I took Fernando on a drive in the Falcon, a rare treat. I did not drive it often. The Falcon was leaking oil and the transmission slipped, but like my mother's rosary beads, I would never get rid of it. I'd already decided to have it completely restored. After all, Fernando would need a car when he turned 16. Mickey and I sensed Fernando was nervous about attending school and decided to take him to OLM for a trial run that we hoped would help ease his nerves. We parked on Cortez Avenue at the foot of the red tile steps leading to the wrought iron gated entrance. I contemplated the countless times my mother had walked me up those steps and the countless times I had run down them to find her waiting for me.
"I'll be right here," she'd say, and she always had been. It was her promise to me, her reassurance that I had nothing to fear, that I was never far from her love. Some afternoons I could not move my feet quickly enough to shuffle down those steps, lunchbox clattering, hurrying to reach her. And when I slid across the seat, I would willingly allow her to embrace me, to feel her unconditional love. It was that same embrace, that same warmth I had felt comforting me the morning I prayed her rosary beads and asked for her to bring Mickey home to me. Have faith, Samuel. She'd never let me down.
"Papá, venga, venga quiero ir,"
Fernando said, shaking me from my reverie. He wanted to keep driving with the top down.
"Quiero mostrarte algo," I said.
"I want to show you something."
"Esto solo tardará un minuto. Ven conmigo."
"It will only take a minute. Come with me." I pushed open the car door. Fernando retrieved the bouquet of flowers we'd bought earlier, and together we all climbed the steps. They appeared more narrow and not as steep as I recalled from my childhood, and because I was taller, she came into view much sooner than when I had been a young boy. I saw her veil, then her face, then the beauty of her blue and white robes. I stopped my ascent.
"Everything okay?"
Mickey asked. It dawned on me where I'd seen the same statue, and I recalled my mother telling me on more than one occasion that the Blessed Mother was always watching over me.
La Virgen de Lourdes, I said to Fernando.
That evening, as Mickey prepared dinner and Fernando lay on the carpet watching television, I sat down on the couch to read the newspaper and heard the bells in the steeple of OLM ringing out the 6 o'clock hour. I'd started to notice the bells more frequently, and each time I did, I closed my eyes and allowed the sound to transport me back to that sunny afternoon outside the rehabilitation center when my father looked up at me from his wheelchair, his body streaked with shadows from the branches of the oak tree, and spoke in his ethereal whisper. There comes a day in every man's life when he stops looking forward and starts looking back. Because of my father's circumstances, I had thought it a sad commentary on life, but I now understood that he was offering me his own gift, one that only time can provide. He was offering me the gift of perspective. My father was telling me that while we tend to remember the dramatic instances that change history, Armstrong's walk on the moon, Nixon's resignation, and the Loma Prieta earthquake, we live for the quiet, intimate moments that mark not our calendars, but our hearts. The day we marry, the days our children are born, their first step, their first word, their first day of school. And when our children grow, we remember those moments with a touch of melancholy. The day they get their driver's license, the day we drive them to college, the day they marry, and the day they have their children. And the cycle begins anew. We realize it is in those quiet moments that each of us has the ability to make our lives extraordinary. I reached into the bowl I kept on the end table, feeling the worn spots where her fingers kneaded each bead. And I started as she taught me. For I am my mother's son. Acknowledgements. I'm not really certain what the genesis for this novel was. It was, I suppose, a number of different things rattling around inside me and looking for a way to escape. The way water will always weep through concrete, no matter how many times the concrete is patched, as Sam Hell observes. I'm one of 10 kids, so the genesis of this novel couldn't very well have been my own childhood, and yet, in a way, I suppose it was. On June 24, 1973, my mother gave birth to her 10th child, Michael Sean Degoni. I was 12 years old and can also remember the births of my two brothers prior to Michael. This was like Christmas mornings for us. I'd awake and my older sisters Eileen and Susie would be in charge, telling me that Mom is in the hospital having a baby. We would all wait with great anticipation for her and my father to return home. On this particular occasion, however, things were different. It was not the joyous occasions of the prior experiences. Two things stood out to me. I remember when my father came home from the hospital, it was without my mother, and he had been crying. His eyes were red and his demeanor subdued. Over the course of the next day or so, I was to learn that my brother Michael had Down syndrome. I didn't fully understand the diagnosis, but I recall asking my brother Bill, "Is he retarded?" My brother looked at me crossly and said, "You better not use that word around Mom." My mother has always been deeply religious and has a special relationship with the Blessed Mother. I recall her saying novenas on many occasions, and especially after the birth of my brother, but God never did fix my brother. In the hospital, doctors told my parents to put my brother in an institution, that he would be a detriment to our family, disruptive and difficult. My mother threw them out of her room. As with Sam Hell's doctors, her doctors didn't know what they were talking about, and they weren't going to prevent her from bringing my brother home. My mother was one to rock the boat, and she rocked the boat mightily when it came to my brother. She was instrumental in getting laws passed that mandated the state educate the mentally disabled. Soon, young mothers with children like my brother would knock on our door to speak with her. My father was not one to rock the boat. He accepted my brother as he was, never expecting that he'd be anything more or less than who he is, just as he accepted each of us. As all of these thoughts rattled in my head, I was sitting in my room at my computer one afternoon, and I found an article in the local newspaper. It was no more than an inch in length. It said that a young boy in Australia had been denied admittance to Catholic school because he had been born with ocular albinism, and the nuns thought he'd be disruptive to the other students. It turned out that the other students had nicknamed this poor child the Devil Boy. That was all that I needed. The first draft of the story poured out of me in 5 weeks. I would find myself writing one scene and jotting down notes for 4 scenes to follow. I would awake at 3 in the morning flooded with dialogue, descriptions, and ideas for future scenes. Writing in first person made the novel personal to me, and I tried to balance that fine line between personal and professional. When I completed that first draft, I made the fatal mistake of letting my agent read it. I've since come to learn that a first draft is written for the writer and should never be shared with anyone. She rightfully did not like the book and told me why. I took this as constructive criticism and over the years pulled the book out to work on it, making wholesale changes to the plot, cutting unnecessary scenes, and molding it into a novel. I'm so grateful to Meg Rooley, Rebecca Scherer, and the team at the Jane Rottrosen Agency. One thing they said that really stuck with me was that the book was too episodic and needed a connecting thread to pull the reader through the story. I found that thread on a drive to, of all places, Mass. I asked myself, what did Sam Hell really want throughout his life? And I found that what he wanted was no different than what I wanted. I think what we all want. Sam wanted to believe. He wanted to believe that God really did have a plan for him and for his life, that his hardships as a child would all help mold for him an extraordinary life. He wanted to believe that his prayers had a purpose, that God truly is benevolent, despite so many in the world so often being malevolent. He wanted to believe that God's will really meant something and was not just a mother's way of dismissing a curious son. So, thanks as always to Meg and Rebecca and the Jane Rottrosen Agency for all your patience, guidance, and perseverance. You push me to write the best novels I can, and it motivates me to do so. Thanks also to Gracie Doyle at Thomas & Mercer, who publishes my mystery and suspense novels and was kind enough to also read Sam Hell. Thanks to Danielle Marshall at Lake Union, my publisher, for her enthusiasm for this project, her guidance, and her steady hand. Thanks to Sarah Shaw, Author Relations, who always makes me feel special. Thanks to Sean Baker, head of production, and to Nicole Pomeroy, production manager. I've said this before, but I love the covers and the titles of each of my novels, and I have them to thank. Thanks to Danelle Catlett, Amazon Publishing PR, for her tireless efforts promoting me and my work. Thanks to publisher Michaela Bruder, associate publisher Galen Maynard, and to Jeff Bell, Vice President of Amazon Publishing. Special thanks to Charlotte Hersher, my developmental editor. This is our 7th book together, and we have become quite a team. Charlotte's suggested edits also struck a chord with me and helped me get out of the way of the story so that the writer could edit, write, and rewrite the novel as never before, shaping and rounding it into a true journey. Thanks to Robin Odell, production editor, and Sarah Brady, copy editor. When you recognize a weakness, it is a wonderful thing, because then you can ask for help. Grammar and punctuation were never my strengths, and it's nice to know I have the best looking out for me. Thanks to Tammy Taylor, who runs my website and creates my newsletters and some of my foreign language book covers. I ask Tammy for help, and she gets things done quickly and efficiently. Thanks to Pam Binder and the Pacific Northwest Writers Association for their support of my work. Thanks to Seattle 7 Writers, a nonprofit collective of Pacific Northwest authors who foster and support the written word. Thanks to you, the readers, for finding my novels and for your incredible support of my work. Thanks for posting your reviews and for emailing me to let me know you've enjoyed them. Always a writer's highlight. Thank you to my mother, Patty, and to my father, Bill, who we lost a decade ago, but who I think about every day. Thanks to all 9 of my brothers and sisters, especially Michael, who inspired so many of my siblings to become doctors, lawyers, a pharmacist like my father, a dental hygienist, an accountant, and a teacher, and to otherwise fulfill all of their potential. They are individuals I admire and respect. Thanks especially to my wife, Christina, and my two children, Joe and Catherine. Thank you for teaching me that the true meaning of success can be found in the quiet moments of my life, the moments when you all fill my heart with love. Thank you for making my life extraordinary. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell by Robert Degoni, performed by the author, directed by Ken Schmidt. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.